Hi there. Thank you for downloading, listening to, and watching the Lean Into Artcast, a show where a couple of visual storytellers get together, take journeys around various topics that tend to occur to one when you go off on this endeavor of communicating with images. We think hard on this stuff, so you will too. My name is Jersey Drozd. I'm a cartoonist and a teaching artist, and the other host is...
Hey, Jersey. I'm Rob Stenzinger. I'm a human being. What's with these titles? But you know, functionally in society, I often perform services related to user experience design, and I also make video games.
Good to see you again, Rob. It's good to get back together to do another one of these episodes. The format of the show, if you're new to it, is that we usually pick one topic per week and we drill down as far as we can with it. In the first half, we look at what it looks like when we engage with this topic, like the practical, like sort of like the how question is answered. In the second half, the why question is answered. We think about like, what do we think about when we're engaging with this particular topic? So, what are we doing this week, Rob?
Well, this is... It's an experiment, right? I know we've dabbled with this before, but this is sort of saying we can visit this idea of critique and do it in a really hands-on way, where essentially you present some of your work, maybe with a question, some kind of framing or whatnot, and then I would present some of my work and with a question or framing, and then in each case, present and then have the other respond to it and explore it thoughtfully, react and dig into it. Essentially the kind of thing that you would like. We've talked about the idea of a brain trust. I think I encountered that in the book. What was it? Creative Confidence, maybe. It's one of those. Yeah. One of those books related to the folks from Pixar or IDEO or what have you, right? And it's been maybe 5 years since I've read it. Anyway, this really appealing idea in there, where it's, you know, it's nice to have those folks that you really trust on call, where you can get some insights. I made a thing. Tell me what you think.
Mm-hmm. The story I like to tell, I won't give all the details because I don't think this one's necessarily ready for prime time viewership, but I was working on a project where somebody pointed out some pretty troubling flaws with the story that the facts that I had set up, the situation I had set up, and the way I executed it. And we were pretty far along in the production of the project, and I was just gobsmacked. I was knocked back. I what do I do? What do I do with this? How do I fix this? And I sent it to Dan Mishkin, who's in one of the people in my brain trust, and he went, oh yeah, it's here, here, and here. And if you just change this line of dialogue to this, and you don't even have to change the art over here. All you have to do is just change this, have this person say this instead of that. And it just fixed everything. And I breathlessly looked across the table and I'm like, how did you do that? And he said, well, you're in the weeds. You know, you're trying not to drown doing this thing right now. So of course you're not going to see that. I have the privilege of standing up here 1,000 feet above where you are. I haven't been involved in the making of this thing. So of course I can see it, right? And that was a really gentle and kind way of him reminding me that, yes, asking for help is a powerful thing. If you happen to find people who you can, you know, trust and rely on to give you honest and direct feedback. Because another thing that Dan actually was helping me just this last week with something I was working on that I'm about to share on my Patreon. And what was I going to say about it? He called me on the phone because he wanted to make sure that I wasn't hurt by any of his critiques, because some of them were pretty direct and pretty intense. Like, here is a thing that you have consistently done that you could do so much better, and you haven't done it better for years, and I've seen you not do it better for years. Why aren't you doing it better, right? And so he's like, look, I just want to make
sure.
Right, yeah.
That's a next level kind of thing. There's deep trust and care.
Right, yeah.
So he called that territory. Wow.
Yeah, and so he just wanted to make sure. He's like, look, I want to hear you when you respond to this. And I'm like, no, man, thank you so much. You are absolutely right. you know, that this is something that I have been ignoring and I need to level up on. And so I did, and I'm happy with what came out of it. But yeah, there was, and maybe we'll talk about that in the second half of the show, like the, how, and maybe we'll model this in the first half of the show, is how we, we're putting ourselves on the line when we do this, even with people we trust, because your work, it's very easy to identify with your work to such a degree that an attack on it feels like an attack on you. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. In your, both parties are putting themselves on the line. It depends on how they engage, right? And I know we'll get into that, because I've received critique from people who aren't necessarily, you know, close, and it can be really helpful or what have you, as far as the whole not pulling punches kind of thing, but also like, why punch? Mm-hmm. You know, why does it have to be a punch? And like, you can deliver difficult information in a variety of ways.
Yeah.
It's so funny. I had a situation where I was asked to critique the user experience of something this week. And it was a situation where I'm like, I need to arrange a call. because there were a lot of matters really that I thought, without context, how could I dig further? And I might share a few more things in a circular way about that later on in the show.
Okay, cool. All right, well, then if there's nothing else to be said, then I think it's time to hit the first half of the show.
I still don't expect it. Woo!
But for those who are new to the show, we use music to create an interlude between the different sections. So in case anybody's just listening to us in the background, it's like just background noise. Like there's like a little signal there to say like, okay, we're getting to the meat of the thing. But I choose that music specifically because it causes Rob to really get pumped up. And we usually get the Rob dance on the show if you're watching a video. maybe we could talk
you
about
switched
why
it up last time. It's so funny. I think. I have a dialogue in my head. I'm like, it'll probably happen. Maybe it won't. I don't know. What's he going to do? And then it happens. I'm like, whoa.
See, there's an argument for me to change it up more often. Okay. So yeah. Who wants to go first? How do you want to, you want to go first? You want me to go first for showing the work? Like when I say who goes first, I'm asking who shows the work first for the other to critique.
Who shows first? I am totally happy to show first.
Okay. So what are you going to show us?
Okay. I am showing page 5 of a mini comic that I created and published last year and only recently have made available on my Gumroad page. And it's a price for, you know, pay what you want, right? Which could be zero. Mm. And so page 5 of Two Pizza Team in a situation called No Trash Talk. And this is the page where the trash turn into a different matter. It goes from a chore from their boss because, you know, they weren't doing their work to, things escalated somehow.
So what we're actually going to do, I should have said this before we started. We're going to critique each other's work. I think you said that at the top, Rob. But yes, now we're actually in the part where we're doing that. So we're looking at a page of Rob's comic, Two Pizza Team. And we're looking at it together. Do you want to give us some context beyond what you've already given us? Like, what's the premise of the thing?
Oh, sure. How about I go through the page? So, like I said, there's so cheese and meat. They're the two pizzas and two pizza team. And cheese is a little bit more out there. You know, very spirited, happy. But then meat is a little more, a bit more serious and down to, you know, all about the business or what have you. And a little more disgruntled. Anyway, so here they are carrying trash. They're both carrying giant trash bags above their heads. And so it's for theater of the mind. For those of you on the video, it's redundant, but it won't take long. Here you go. So Cheese goes, "Oh, this is good exercise." He's carrying a giant trash bag over his head. He or she, I don't know what their genders are, to be honest, but makes you, meat goes, makes you stink like a workout. I give you that. Also carrying a giant trash bag. And as they make it to the dumpster behind the restaurant, Cheese goes, "Ha ha, ew, my bag's all wiggly." And his bag is not stable anymore. Something's happening there. And meat goes, "Wiggling trash can't be good." then all of a sudden, boom, tamoo, like there's an explosion, and the little bags somehow appear. More, there's more bags than two, and Cheese and Meat go flying. Next, we see the final panel, and Cheese goes, "This tickles. Hey, Meat, you got some trash on your back." And the trash is all these little bags now, kind of run amok and stomping on the little pizzas. And they go, "Yes, we did it." Another one's, "Deal with it." Another one's all victory chanting, "Untouchable." And the other one goes, "Womp, womp, womp." And finally, the last little trash bag goes, "We refusers refuse the dumpster." And Meat's like, "Not helpful, Cheese pal." All right. That's the page. Mm-hmm. And the context, as far as my, you know, the critique, I want your reactions, as far as initial reactions, deeper reactions, thoughtful other things, as far as your key heuristics, your areas of concern that you care a lot about. A thing I'm in particular concerned about is the amount of moments. And I feel like I have a long-term habit I'm trying to work on related to how I compress story. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate so many stories and now have tuned into this thing that I'm trying to work on, but I battle, right? I mean, this is my most recent comic, right? That I've published at least. And it's fairly compressed. There isn't a lot of something happens. Someone goes, "Something happened." And then something else happened. And then someone goes, "Something happened." And then maybe two other people go, "Something totally happened." And there's reactions that build up the context, right? Which is something I very much appreciate in a variety of media. But of course, things like Dragon Ball, Dragon Ball Z, what have you. and it's something I'm trying to work on. Anyway, there you go. There's my context for feedback.
Okay. So are you saying specifically that you look for a little bit more decompression and you're trying to look for the decompressed moments to like give the action some space to breathe? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, because I know I don't want to make every moment drawn out, but where there's one little thing happens and then there's a reaction, one other little thing happens, but there's got to be a pacing and a rhythm to it that I want to get a better taste for and start to practice. Mm-hmm. So like that's almost a what if scenario of like, well, what if new version of this comic and, you know, find a moment for reaction. And along with though, your bag of heuristics, concerns, rules of thumb that to me, that has the benefit of the fresh perspective.
Sure. So let me start by saying something that you're doing like absolutely like if we are operating under the assumption that what you're trying to achieve here is clarity, then one thing you've done that achieves clarity is you're observing the 180 rule in comics. 180 rule, it's not a rule, it's a rule of thumb, if anything. It's a suggestion in that your characters are remaining in the same side of the page panel for panel, right? And this is something that I think a lot of people sometimes miss. And if you're going to do it to intentionally create like a sense of ambiguity or confusion or chaos, then that's one thing. But if you're trying to do like a straight scene where you're actually following all the action clearly, it's a good idea to keep your characters in relation into the on the same side of each panel, no matter where you're putting the viewing angle. So, for instance, like. And you've got almost the same viewing angle throughout this entire page, but at the same time you're zooming out and you're closing in, and actually like looks like between panel one's a straight on horizontal, panel two looks like it's almost a 3/4 down shot, but anyway, just identifying that to say like keep doing that is always a good idea, right? Also, another thing that I like what you're doing is that you're not smushing the word balloons like right up next to the characters. Like I think that's another thing that I catch people doing sometimes that really kind of bums me out. Like they don't have to be, as long as the tail, generally speaking, is getting to pointing towards their mouth, then you're doing the job. And the balloons can be quite far away. So like you look at panel two, when Cheese is saying the part about the bag is all wiggly, the balloon isn't like right next to cheese, right? I could see somebody using that negative space next to cheese and being tempted to say, well, that's where the balloon needs to go. But then you run the risk of now it's not higher than the second balloon in there. And there's, while it's a slim chance, there would be a chance of not knowing exactly which line is spoken first, right? But as long as your first one is in the upper left and your last one is generally speaking towards the bottom right, people will know what order to read, right? So now let's get to when you talk about pacing. I'm curious, was it intentional, the sizes that you chose for the panels, or were you just like, were you being instinctual when it came to that?
Let's see.
Or do you even remember?
I think it's, yeah. I mean, it was fairly instinctual and a matter of essentially story chunks or beats without necessarily emphasis. So I think that question, you know, leads me to think that I could have had greater rhythm across the panels by having a difference in their size, more of a difference. That's something I'm thinking of too, is that especially when I tell a story in a mini comic and I'm really concerned about space, I think panel size is something I should look at more than panel shape.
Mm.
And so I played around with panel shape probably more than was necessary.
I don't know. This is one of those ones where I would say, I don't think there's a right or wrong answer on this. I'm just was asking what, if this was intentional, because you got guys like Keith Giffen and before him, Steve Ditko, who, and even Jack Kirby, who worked with grids all the time. Like Jack Kirby did like a 4-panel grid and a 6-panel grid, and Ditko famously used 9-panel grids all the time and still got incredibly dramatic work done and lots of pacing in it. So I don't think it's while size is like, it's an easy thing to point at going like, well, maybe the part when the trash bags explode should be the biggest panel on the page. Maybe that would be a way to achieve that and give it the sense of anticipation by having these two smaller panels followed by the great big giant bum-da-dum panel. But another thing, so when I point to guys like Ditko, Kirby, that they did to play with pacing is, what would happen? How would panel two feel if instead of looking straight on at the characters, we're kind of looking over their shoulders with the garbage bin framed between them? So we're looking over cheese and meat's shoulders, right? They're walking towards, mm-hmm. So in the distance, directly in front of us is the dumpster. And we see just in the tops of the panels, like, so the wiggling bags just cut off by the top of the panel. So we see just like the very, very bottom of the bag kind of wiggling around while we're looking over their shoulders, and they are almost silhouetted. They're almost like darkened out to the point where, because we don't need to see their expression necessarily here. Now we just need to see they're almost to the trash can, and we're right underneath the trash bags with them while the trash bags are wiggling, right? How would that, not even thinking about size, how would that change the way that moment feels versus what you've got here, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it creates greater concern over the, like, what is happening with those darn trash bags. Something is not right.
In the scary movies, yeah. Whenever somebody's about to open a door that you don't want them to open, right? You're always like right up close to their hand as it reaches for the doorknob. It's never like a straight on, like horizontal shot. It's never like an objective full wide shot. It's always like you're right on that hand as it's about to grip the doorknob, right? And there's a reason why that's such a powerful image, right? Because now you're in it. You are about to open that door with that person, right? Versus I'm watching security footage of a person opening a door.
So, oh, that's great.
So
now you're in it.
And so you think about pacing. It's not just, see, this is where like you can get lost in this comic stuff, and this is why I love it so much, because it's not just the panel size that is controlling your pacing, and it's not just the moments you choose that are controlling your pacing, because you could add some panels in there. You could have maybe 3 panels of them walking towards the dumpster and the dumpster getting closer while cheese is saying, oh, this is getting really wiggly. And that would create a sense of pace. That would build some anticipation. But so you got that. But then you also have the way you look at the scene to create a sense of pacing. So a single image can feel faster or slower depending on what angle you're looking, right? Which is weird to think about. It's super weird to think about, but it changes our emotional reaction to it, and which changes the way that the pacing feels. So
that's really cool. And yeah, something that, could really, you could take advantage of that by, you know, maybe not having additional real estate dedicated to panels, but then how fascinating. The angle itself. I mean, it changed the amount of tension, your suggestion to go with that overhead, and the bags are kind of close to the viewer and all that with panel two. That's a perfect example.
And going back to what Dan said to me, is that this is the kind of thing that I can see very clearly because I wasn't in there fighting all of those decisions like you were when you were doing it. Right. And this is where checking in with a brain trust is so valuable because, yeah, when you're writing this, you're trying to think of like, how can cheese say that this bag is moving in a way that only cheese would say it? How is meat going to react to that? How do I draw the wriggling bag? Right. How do I draw the background in this scene? How am I going to lay out the page that the information flows well? Right. There's so many things you have to think about that it's easy to not. I don't even want to say miss. I'm saying it's easy for me to see other opportunities because I didn't have to do all that cognitive front loading that you had to get through making the page. So I want to grab onto that language and I want to save it for the second half because I think that that language and that thought I think is crucial for how I experience and how I give critique. So then we get to the final panel, and Shadowing was actually commenting on this as well, is that so you have this moment where meat and cheese are having an interaction with one another, and I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, Rob, the feeling you wanted here is they're talking to each other while all these little gremlins are just dancing on them and having their own conversation about, yeah, we're being defiant, but neither meat nor cheese are responding to them directly, correct?
Right, not yet.
So yes, so it says this tickles. Hey meat, you got some trash in your back. And then meat says, not helpful, cheese pal. Right, that's the exchange between them. And so that's like sort of like the front channel or top channel of sound. The second channel is the noise that all of the trashlings are making. Right. So when you have all those sounds in the same shape balloon, it feels like they're all the same volume. So now when I'm reading it, I'm going like, this tickles. Yes, we did it. Hey, meat, deal with it. You got some trash in your back. Untouchable. Womp, womp, womp. Refusers refuse the dumpster. Not helpful, cheese pal. And so now it's a little ambiguous as to whether meat is responding to the trashlings or the refusers or cheese, even though he does say cheese pal, which is like, that does help the clarity a little bit. Now, how would it change if you instead took the balloons away from all of the refusers and just had little black lines pointing to their mouths and just having the words suspended in midair?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, creating emphasis and de-emphasis so there's greater contrast between the channels. I like that way of looking at it. That's a useful construct.
However, I would say that I have known cartoonists who absolutely despise taking sound elements out of balloons, right? I do it all the darn time. I think it's a useful tool to let the words like hang in the air because it de-emphasizes them. It makes them feel like they're more of a background element, like a sound effect, right? Like that's part of the background texture of noise in the story. But I know it's not for everybody. So even as I say, well, that might make it a little bit more clear, I would say that with the grain of salt saying, but if you are stylistically opposed to doing that, don't do it. You could also do it with color change.
Exactly. Yep. That the balloons could have another style.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Or even the text within them could be like a light gray or something.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much. Yes, exactly that. That's really helpful. That's some awesome observations and thought tools that I'm only, that I'm hearing I'm only, so far.
I'm only just now noticing that one of the sound effects is Timu. Boom, Timu. That's a great sound effect.
Well, it's funny because for some reason I made myself laugh because in the it's funny that it translates in the pencil sketch, right, version. I actually said Pumbaa and Timon, or actually it was Timon and Pumbaa, right? And for some reason, that was funny as a sound effect. Timon, Pumbaa, you know? And like, why? But yeah. So I decided to, you know, switch it up a little bit and carry it on in spirit.
Well, that's good. Shadowing is also, Troy is suggesting in the chat, or even making the refuser's dialogue a bit smaller, or even making it lowercase, right? There's a lot of options there to create a volume difference between, you know, two different channels of speech. So, I mean, I love the idea, like, so we talk about compression. The way that panel works for me is that you've got something that is essentially like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 discrete moments in one drawing, right? Mm-hmm. And like that's where comics really excels as a medium, is that you can find these moments like that are like sort of super moments made up of a lot of different moments in time, yet we read them as like one image that it doesn't feel incorrect, right? Like if you think about it.
I very much embrace that. Yeah. I've embraced it, I think, to the point where I question it. Because like in the hundreds of comics I made for Art Geek Zoo, it was, I almost looked at each comic like a tapestry, almost like the kind of things that were there, like so many moments could appear adjacent to one another in, you know, some like in a tapestry that captured the story of a battle or whatever. Mm-hmm. And for me that, you know, I had all these, my rules of thumb for every update that I had to reveal something about the world and the background. And I needed to have a moment between the characters, and they needed to answer a question that happened before and needed to raise a new question. It had to have something funny anyway. I tried to do that every single page. Mm-hmm. And so it led to, I embraced,
the compression,
the compression.
Yeah. And I mean, and then going back to like your initial wondering about this is like, let's look at that last moment on the page again, which I actually wouldn't change. I think it's really lovely and very comic booky the way you did that. But would it feel different if after the big explosion panel, you close right in on Meat's face and we have the little guys jumping on his back and you just have like this reaction moment of him like what? And then you back away again and you see them all dancing on them. And then you see Cheese like smiling happily about like, oh, this tickles, right? Like creating that one little tiny panel where just you get like right in and on his face, right?
That's the spicy meatball I'm looking for, right? That's the thing where key moments of decompression, mm-hmm, to just slip into the bigger set of panels of tapestries of hyper or mega moments, right? Mm-hmm. That's what I want to figure out. I want that skill.
So I guess like a question that I ask myself when I'm writing these kinds of stories, and I do it more intuitively now. I don't actually like have like a chart or anything that I go to, but when a moment happens in the story where something big happens, or if there's a punchline, like let's say just a punchline happens. And I know there's a page in Boulder and Fleet Mining for Trouble that I can think of that I can't pull up right away, but it's at boulderandfleet.com. And anybody who's read Mining for Trouble, there's this part where the two of the first villains we meet in the story are arguing in this cave. Like they're about to make their dramatic exit of the cave to announce themselves as the villains of the story. And the two of them are arguing over the right way to do it. And then while they're arguing, one of them points to the heroes at the end of the cave going like, yeah, you think we should get out there by now? Because we've been arguing for 5 minutes and they're waiting for us, you know? And then finally, Sapphire, the girl who's like being really dramatic about it, just has this moment where it's this little tiny panel where she closes up like this, closes up her whole body. And she's like, okay, Saf, you got this. Let's do this. And then it's a big panel of her like doing this dramatic posing. All right, we're the gem girls or whatever, right?
Mm. Yep, I remember that actually. Yep.
So it's like, just like, how does the character feel about what just happened? And can you get in close on their face to give us, the reader, a chance to connect with that emotion that they're having, right? Especially in the case of like this, where it would be an opportunity to like sell the gags. Like, okay, wait a minute. They had trash bags on their backs that exploded. I saw little goblins. And now we close in on Meat going like, what? And then back out again, right? That kind of thing. As a possibility.
Yeah. I love it. Yes. That's where I'd like to go. That one check-in, it's like I've, there's moments of emotion in this, you know, the thing I've practiced, but those super moments do lack a certain punctuation. And that context, like you described, of really getting that check-in moment, that's got to be criteria that I evaluate as far as doing a new version of this or like the next one.
And I would also submit that a way to also think about this as you progress forward with this is, I'm sure there are times in your life where if there was an imaginary audience watching your life, you would turn to them like Mr. Roper and do like a kind of face at the audience, right?
Oh boy.
That's that moment. Yeah. That's the moment in your story, right? Is like whenever that happens to you, make a note of it, because that's something that could happen to your characters in your story. And that's the part where they don't necessarily look directly at the reader, but you take the moment to put the reader right in front of them. So that's how I like to think about it anyway. And you know what's really cool? Another artist would probably say something totally different.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is one of those things where, and honestly, if we have this conversation on a different day, that would, you know, your feedback would have a different emphasis, different flow, all that kind of stuff. I'm me on this day at this time presenting this work, and you know, you're you, and there's going to be variety. And of course that gets cranked up as far as presenting to other artists. And that's where, I mean, it depends. Like, you don't always need to go hunt for lots of feedback, right? If it rings true and it serves the purpose, it fits with your goals and intent. I don't know if it's always suitable to say, hey, I'd like to spin my wheels for a lot longer. And then have tons more ambiguity trying to reconcile all these different perspectives.
Yep.
Anyway.
Yeah. All right.
Sometimes it's really useful, but I think for more specific questions, not the big wide open ones.
I agree.
Because other people will be like, why aren't they squirrels? You know?
Yeah.
Squirrels are way more interesting than pizzas. Pizzas, what? And it's like, okay, well, thanks for your time. Yeah.
Okay. Any other final thoughts, questions, wonderings about your page? Or do we want to move on?
No, I feel like I gained a lot of takeaways from that. I really appreciate it.
Cool. All right. So now it's my turn. And the page that I chose was from a mini comic I did a few years back called Pickles and Taft Adventures for Hire, which you can also get on Gumroad at a price of your choosing, even free. It's an 8-page mini comic. It's 10-page PDF. And the premise of the story is that it's a pig and her battle tortoise who are adventurers for hire. So in other words, they go on adventures and hope to make money off of it. And like my other adventurers for hire, they're always broke. And Pickles wants to go to this festival, Septoberfest, because there's dancing. And Taft, the grumpy tortoise, is like, I'm not going because I don't really care about dancing. But then Pickles informs her best friend. Let me turn the page. That they have a pierogi bar, which is people who pronounce things with an American accent say a pierogi bar. And it turns out Taft's a big sucker for pierogi. So now he's interested in going, but now they got to like figure out how to raise money. And they go on this adventure where they work for a chicken wizard to stop a dark chicken wizard at the top of a mountain. And there's a surprise ending. But the page that I chose was this dramatic moment from the story where they're climbing the mountain with the chicken wizard, and the evil chicken sorcerer is throwing lightning bolts at them from the top of the mountain. And as they're, you know, trying to traverse the mountain pass, you know, it's kind of dangerous. So Pickle says, well, I'm going to draw. Well, I'll just read the panels here. Pickle says, I'll draw his fire. You get Xenia to the peak. And the crack a cow, lightning bolt. And Taft says, wait, don't just. And then Pickle starts dancing around the lightning. Patah, krakow, patah, krakow. Whoa. Pickle starts to fall. Taff jumps forward and says, Pickles! And he catches Pickles by the leg. And she says, oh, Taft grumbles in his balloon. And then Pickles says, ha, 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 that was almost bad. Ow, my leg. And then Xenia, the lady chicken wizard, says, very clever, Ms. Pig. You got him to deplete some of his power. And Pickle says, sure, why not? Of course, she meant to do that. So now this is one of those pages where I feel like my relationship with myself as an artist is there's the me who shows up and says, let's just do the job and let's just do it as best as we can. And then there's the me who gets a little pleased with himself and looks in the mirror and crosses his arms, goes like, yeah, but I make like inventive adventure comics. I'm always looking to like push just a little bit of the form a little farther just to show everybody else how to do this. I will admit that that guy is inside me. It's the guy from the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon with the shield, you know, the one that Donnie Most played. He's in there. And this is one of those pages, or rather, I should say, when that part of myself expresses itself in comics, sometimes I look back and go like, oh, stop it. Just stop. You're making it too busy now. And now it's not clear anymore, right? Like, you had to show off instead of just tell the darn story, right? So I worry that this page is a little bit confusing, not as easy to read as it could be, and that it's trying to... I feel like it's being a bit showy in how the panels interact with one another, like how Pickles is falling in panel 2 and Taft is jumping at her in panel 3 and catching her in panel 4 to like imply this that the, you know, in panel 2 Pickles is doing like, it's one of those shots where there's multiples of the character performing all the actions, and how when she's falling, panel 4 is the pit she was about to fall into from panel 2, right? It's me trying to be clever. And so my main concern is that it's a little bit unclear. And my second concern is that it's just a bit too busy for black and white. Like if I had color on this, maybe it'd be a different thing. So my question for you, Rob, contexting or giving the context of my concerns about it, that notwithstanding, if you have a totally different assessment of this page, I'd like to hear it. And I would ask the question, if you could do one thing to make this page a little bit more clear, what would it be?
So let's see. I really liked how you opened up, and as far as exploring the critique, and there is so much about this page where it's very it's inviting. It's almost like a tunnel of light down the middle. That, I mean, it starts with that black corner up above the darkness, but you know, there's a lot of, you know, value to hint where you go. Like if I, you know, like, I didn't need to squint my eyes, but if I squint my eyes and look at it, I can see this S in the page that's almost telling me to, you know, follow it. Like water pouring down some cracks in a wall. Right. Mm-hmm. And the intensity juxtaposed with the cuteness of the characters is really, it's just pulls you right in. And then there's the, there is what you describe, which is I think incredibly intentional, purposeful style. Like when someone has the, vocabulary and expertise to do a lot with the medium, right? So this is like, to me, this is a little bit of a guitar solo page, right? And it's a solo that has some acrobatics in it, right? Where mm-hmm. a solo that's like, oh crap, a guitar can do that. And then, but you know, it doesn't lose the song, right? So it's doing a job that, has this, the sudden like density and intensity, like at the same time, which in, you know, like having density and intensity, it's there's you know, it's like being in a crowd. It's a mosh pit of a page in a way. Right. So density and intensity. So that is, but at the same time, it's not a mosh pit because, or it is if, there's a person or people that you care about in this intense boil of humanity, if they're it's, they pop out in color and everyone else is in black and white, right? So like there is contrast there. You see what's happening. It's like so it's super intense. So let's see. Excuse me. All that said, is there one thing I would change in almost like you're implying that it, maybe it's too busy. So, I mean, you're a guitar soloist that has a self-awareness and saying, I want people to still hear the melody. Right. And that's having that, I mean, that's a thoughtful soloist kind of thing. Now, is it too busy for black and white? I really, honestly, I don't think so. I could see how, I mean, part of it's the value, right? It's not really, I mean, even when you add color, you could actually create less value, right? The emphasis and de-emphasis between the different regions and the shapes could become more ambiguous if there's actual color present here. So I don't know. That's a neutral call because honestly, adding color to this, you would have color with a lot of rendering, I think, would create risk. So anyway, I think it's more clear for the lack of it. But if color in the whole abstract reality and simple shapes kind of thing, maybe, right? Like if, for instance, if pickles were pink or what have you, I don't know what color is pickles.
Oh, she's pink.
She's pink. Okay. So if pickles is pink, and you see this pink acrobatic, you know, wizard flipping through the thing. I don't know. Maybe that's an interesting consideration. Mm-hmm. Artistic choice to say that it's this one. Like the red dress in the Matrix kind of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is the one that has my attention.
If you did it with like a limited color palette, right? So like maybe I'll use like pink and green and a brown for the color palette on this thing, right?
Sure.
And then, yeah, something like that. Also, I don't know. Now that you got me thinking about value, I think part of my concern about this page is that I'm creating a sense of focus by graying out the background, but I wonder if the texture of the brushwork behind everybody, like if, would that work better if I just use flat black? Like if the background's on behind
flat gray
or even flat gray. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause the angles on the black, create that pull that this natural, compositional flow. Mm-hmm. It reinforces it. Like it works in harmony with the panels. Mm-hmm. Like from a visual information emphasis and hierarchy of saying, pay attention to wah right there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so if you did go flat, I would consider keeping those regions. I mean, you know, if you change the rendering, I don't know. I wonder how that would look.
Yeah. So like, this is a situation where I was intentionally, so this, as all my projects are, this had a level of experimentation involved in it, in that I drew it 100% in Clip Studio Paint, but I was trying to make it look like what my work looks like when I use brush pen on Bristol board. So I was trying to recreate a analog look on a pure digital drawing experience. And I know I didn't quite hit it all the time, but when it came to doing the shading in the background, I think a simple gradient would have made the foreground elements pop more, but I didn't feel like I had the latitude to do that because I was trying to make this look like I drew it all on paper 100% with brushes, right?
So sure. So a flat gray region would cause this, it would violate that design principle you chose for the project. Mm-hmm. But then there's things like ink washes, right?
Right, right. You're absolutely right. I could have done, say, like with like a watercolor brush in Clip Studio Paint to do the background there. I should play with that and see how it comes across. Because that is exactly something that was available to me when I worked on this. Carrie is in the chat saying, if there's one thing I think would help Jersey's concerns, it would be to lighten the deepest background of the background. So you think that the high contrast in the corners, like if I lighten that, is that what you're saying, Carrie? I wonder.
Interesting. Yeah, I do wonder. And while Carrie's forming that thought, I, as far as one thing I would change, I think of I don't always accomplish it, but like having the strong entrance and exit for a page, and there's that the actor's moment. Down, do you use a lot of, it seems like it's, what do they call that when everything is worked into the environment, like the emotional elements and all that stuff. It's, or like background music. It's the, like if you have background music in a scene and it was meant to be there and it happens to play with the story as it's playing out versus background music that's imposed and it's in someone's head or it's in the director's mind or, you know, it's meant to just affect you as a viewer. That kind of thing I think about. So I wouldn't want to go against any of those choices you've made as far as, but like some kind of that moment, like the moment where like there's a poof when Taft catches Pickles, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a bigger moment in my opinion. That's the one thing I would, it's like, you have the entrance is like, boom, it's coming in. And then there's all this intensity, which I find very appealing, work as a reader to be, because it's almost like a magic, you're getting to see like a magic trick, some highly skilled in, you know, rapidly happening set of events that in order to perceive it takes work, right? Mm-hmm. And so this thing happens, but then the end of it I'm not sure what I would do, but I would wonder about ways to have it hit mm-hmm. somehow.
Yeah, like if I had more room, or if I wanted to add an extra page to the story, close in tight on him catching her foot and then pull way back to show how far she could have fallen had it not been for him, you know, zooming back to show the spikes at the bottom of the pit, zooming back to show the sharks in the water, right? Whatever it was. But like, first you go like the catch and then zoom way far back so that they're really tiny. And then we see the context of like where she almost fell to.
Right? That kind of thing. Wow.
That I see what you're saying. Carrie clarified her points from earlier. So making those heavy blacks a bit lighter would push the action elements forward more. Interesting, because that was what I was fighting with when I was doing the page. It was like, how do I make these stand out more? But maybe you're saying that because there's those big black spots in the corners, that's what's like creating like weight there for you. I'm drawing our eye away from that. Maybe that could very well be. So, cool.
Very good.
All good food for thought. So,
what do you think?
I think it's time to take a break, and then let's talk about what we did. What do you think?
All right. I look forward to that. Yeah, I will withhold my question until we get there.
Oh, you have a question?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. We'll save it for the second half. All right. We're going to take a few minutes to thank some people who make this show possible, and those people happen to be the folks who support us on Patreon. Yes, patreon.com/leanintoart is the website. I said that too fast. patreon.com/leanintoart. The show is called Lean Into Art. You should know that by now. And that's the address to the place where you can give us a monthly upvote and say, I believe in Jersey. I believe in Rob. I want to thank them for what they do and help make the show more sustainable by donating as little as $1 a month. And we want to thank 5 people who have been doing exactly that lately. First up, India Swift. Thank you, India. And you can find India's work on her Twitter at Old Swifty. Also, Rachel Ross, longtime friend of the show. Thank you, Rachel, for believing in us and what we do. You can find Rachel on Twitter at NYCTERIS. These will all be linked in the show notes, by the way. Speaking of which, why do we talk about these people who have the Twitter handles in the show? It's to publicly thank them, but it's also to say, like, hey, if they get something out of the show, you'll probably want to connect with them and maybe talk about art with them. You could start to, you know, assemble your own brain trust. So continuing on, Ben Odgren. Thank you, Ben. You can find Ben on Twitter at Ben Odgren. Nate Marcel. Thank you, Nate. Nate's been doing really awesome work on Twitter as well. You can find it by following him at Great Sea Monster. And lastly, the mysterious K. Thank you, K, for believing in us and what we do. And you can join them at patreon.com/leanintoart, where you'll find all the shows we make, as well as the extra leans, the shows we record in between. And they're only available to people who support us on Patreon. Those posts become an open mic post where you can talk about whatever you want with fellow leaners. And we thank you for your support there at patreon.com/leanintoart. It means a lot to us.
It really does. And we'll be posting I did do that close to the beginning of the month. And, you know, we do get to it. And a new one's coming very soon.
You're talking about the extra lean? You blipped out
extra
a little
lean?
Bit there. Okay.
Oh, I did. I blip out sometimes. It's a glitch. It's a thing.
Okay, so time for a little bit more music to get us know we're in the next part of the next section of the show, and this one's for Rachel, who was mentioned in the ad just a moment ago.
Okay, all flight controllers,
go for power descent. Okay, now we're in the part of the show where we talk about when we're doing this stuff. So what did we just do? And you had a question to kick off this section, Rob.
Yeah, so, what do I say here? Different artists, different paths, different strengths, different emphasis, what have you. Now, we have different strengths. And what do you think about taking critique from someone who has different strengths than you?
Different strengths mean different perspectives, which mean different worldviews and different approaches, which is stuff that I don't have. Therefore, it is potentially innumerably valuable because it's a perspective that I just don't have access to, right? I keep thinking of this idea of like people who go into lines of work where they get exposed to a lot of different personality types so that they can collect a lot of characters. My personal view on critique when I'm getting critique from people is, and I didn't always have this, right? This isn't something I've had since I was 16 years old. I mean, if you would have critiqued my work like you did when I was 16, I probably would have like kicked a bunch of dirt around and swore a little bit and marched off into the woods for an hour, you know, and like felt sorry for myself and come back and like, you don't even know what they're talking about. I'm a super genius, you know? But the way I evaluate critique is it helpful to me in that it either gives me some more context and perspective on approaches I could be taking, or is it teaching me something? Is it pointing out a blind spot that I previously, or that I didn't know I had, right? One of my very first conversations with Dan Mishkin was he pointed out how my word balloon design sucked, and he didn't pull any punches with it. And like that was the beginning of me becoming fascinated with sound design, because the moment he said that, I looked at what he was pointing to. I was like, oh my gosh, you're right. Oh my gosh, I have not been thinking very hard about this. And this was 2006. It sent me on a quest, right? Like it was really like, you know, like Johnny Cash as a coyote came up and started talking to me.
Okay. Yeah. Wow.
So.
Yeah. Not all critique needs to be gentle to be valuable. That is for sure.
Right. It didn't feel great because it was like there was a couple things going on there. One, I thought that I was really smart about this stuff. And two, I was talking to somebody who was a childhood hero and I was trying to impress him. And so when he very kindly, but very point blank, pointed out something that was like dramatically, what am I trying to say? There was a lot of growth that needed to be done there. And he did not pull any punches when he said it. It hurt. It stung a lot, and I had a hard time swallowing that pill. But like in the moment, I could acknowledge that, yep, you just pointed out like a huge flaw in my work, and it's super embarrassing. I had a conversation with a friend not long ago where I got duped by a fake movie trailer video. It was like for some movie that was coming out. I was like, hey, did you see the new trailer for such and such video? And then like they watched it and like, nope, that's a fake. And I was like, oh. And I was really disappointed because like the movie wasn't going to get made. And then my friend said to me, he's like, yeah, it sucks. It feels kind of ashamed when you get tricked that way. And I was like, well, I didn't even think about the shame until just now. It was more about the disappointment that this thing that I wanted to get made isn't getting made. But you know, it's like I can see we live in a world where, you know, shame. Well, we've talked about this. Like you're in a room with failure. Everybody wash yourselves quickly, you know. Shame is an easy emotion to come in contact with. And so I try to be mindful of that. Like, yeah, shame happens. But what's your goal? Your goal is to improve as an artist and to constantly be leveling up so that it never gets boring. So if somebody points out something that's
with the given source, was shame their goal, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's which can be the case, and they still might be right.
Yeah,
but I think it's important to
That's a good point.
Try to, yeah, find a way to weigh it out still.
Because if somebody comes at me with an aggressive comment, if there's any truth in it, then I'm grateful for it. If it's just pure aggression, just trying to make me feel bad, then, well, it may or may not make me feel bad. It depends. But it's not going to stay with me very long, right? Like,
That's really generous. Are you really grateful for it? Because I'm tolerant of it. Because I see people have different needs and personalities and whatnot, right? So if someone, like, you know, has this extra envelope of aggression with some useful information in it, yeah, I'll always be like, this is gross in my head. I'd be like,
yeah.
This envelope sucks.
Yeah.
I acknowledge what's inside. And, you know, hopefully we can just, you know, have a peaceful exchange or whatever. But
I am not going to want to be friends with that person. Right. Like, it's like, why are you so shouty about it? Like, why do you got to yell and use those words? Right. But thank you for pointing out that thing that I was doing incorrectly. And now that's good data for me to proceed forward. Like, I'll be grateful for the learning, not necessarily for the way it was said. Right. Mm-hmm. So for instance, like the example I always go to is like how when I'm driving a car, the horn is only to tell other people, be careful. Right. It's only like, oh, I might hit you if you do what you're going to do. You know, like that's when the horn gets deployed. It's only in emergencies. It's never to critique anybody else's driving. Right. And so like, if I
saw a great hack for a horn. Yeah. And what was it? It was one of those famous YouTube science people or whatever. And they made a three purpose horn with different tones. Right. Oh, and so, yeah. And it really could carry like a really and then the womp and the, yeah, really different contexts. Like, you know, one is like a red alert. Mm-hmm. There's danger imminent. Wake up. Right. And anyway, but yeah, it'd be nice to have subtlety.
It would. Yeah. Cause like, you know, that thing when you get stuck behind somebody at a light and the light changes and they don't know, and they're like, whatever is going on in their car is going on in their car, but like a full, like 20 seconds will pass. And then there's gotta be a polite way to be like, hey, light screen, you know, like you're holding everybody up, careful. And I'll try my hardest to do like a little beep beep as best I can. Sometimes I'm not successful.
You really have to finesse it. And it's not all horns are easy to finesse.
Yeah, that's true. But anyway, that was all to point out that like as people just witnessed, my critiques are usually pretty gentle, but I try to point to, well, what if you just did this? How would it change what you're doing if you thought about it this way, right? It's not to say that you did it incorrectly. You know, you were telling a story about two pizzas taking the trash out, and that is communicated in there. You were asking how you could punch that up. Well, let's think about what are your options. Your options are panel size, your options are moment choice, and your options are viewing angle, right? So let's play with that and see how it changes what happens. So based on what you said your intention was and what your concerns were, these are things that I would point to as options to play with that, right? I don't know. Looking for possibility is like a way that I like to do it. But that's also, I probably comes from my teaching work. Yeah.
Well, and I try to hunt for criteria as far as goals or purpose or context or building blocks, and then say that this is what this person defines the problem as. And I want to make sure I understand how they frame the problem. And also, as we talk about it, each of those building blocks may become may have extra context of like, well, this one was like you mentioned how you used, digital media, but tried to accomplish analog aesthetic, and that, you know, maybe had attention as far as some aspect of the background rendering. And that was great to hear, right? Great to explore as far as like, now it's like, I can take in information and I can just carry with me whatever I already had when I came into the conversation. But I always feel like that's not enough. I have my, and I want to understand where you go. So I know where the meaning is. If that makes sense.
Say the last part again, because like it dropped out like for like a full 2 seconds while you're talking.
Dropped out again. So I try to understand where the other person is coming from and what their intent is, and also their chosen constraints, so that gives me context to weigh out the like how they navigated that path, mm-hmm. and the outcome that is the work that we're talking about. The work is an end of a path. It's not the path itself. So I try to get there through some kind of purposeful journey with the person sharing the work.
Trying to figure out what they were going for, right? Yeah. Because another thing that's
a lot quicker way to say that.
Oh, well, no, it's just a different way of saying it. But there's in Troy's comment in the chat, it's actually making me think about this. He says, I always, because Troy does a review site, he says, I always try to be fair and honest when I do reviews, but sometimes the people who worked on what I reviewed find them, and I don't want to be a jerk about it, especially if I'm reviewing a friend's work. Now, there's a difference in what you're doing there, Troy, where you're just like straight up reviewing something versus having a direct conversation with a person. Because, and what's more is, so like we have the advantage in this situation that Rob can like interview me to find out what I was going for with this thing. But then I have a declaration of what I'm going for and what I think the problem is. But I don't necessarily see, as the person who's getting critiqued, I'm not the most reliable narrator as to what the problem really is either, right? So it's like you can respond to their concerns, but then I wonder how much of that is like, how much, Rob, in your experience, do you also say, and while we're on the subject of this thing, I noticed this, this, and this about your piece. Because I offered that critique of Two Pizza Team where I said, well, this final panel, you have the sound thing going on, right? You didn't ask about that, but I offered it because I was like, well, while we're picking this page apart, let's also notice and this too.
I intentionally tried to open the door for that in the beginning. So whether or not you had that with you, you know, when we arrived at that point in the conversation, I did mention that I wanted to hear your reactions based on your typical concerns and heuristics, your rules of thumb that you carry with you, because you're going to bring a different perspective than I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, let's see. There's always this other context, because then it's like, well, what if we work together in the same publishing house? What if we, and so now there's these, this other set of rules and criteria. There's always, you know, so it's, I don't know, it's important to acknowledge this. And honestly, if like I do have my own informed expertise in different media, and I would, you know, it depends on what we're talking about, right? So like if you designed a game or an app, I think I would say more additional criteria and tools and stuff that I might bring to the conversation because of our different experience in that domain. But then with comics, I was like, well, I think my toolbox is going to be a lot smaller when a conversation between you and I, because this is your thing and you have, a lot more experience and practice in this area.
Maybe. I don't know. But he's like,
and that does affect my critique. I mean, would that affect yours, or wouldn't it? Or
so that's an interesting question, because then there's also that common advice of like, and I'm sure that's the same thing in UI UX design, is let somebody play with it who's not an expert on it. Like, let the common person off the street.
That's usability. That's like fitness for purpose testing, usability testing, that kind of thing.
And the same, and like common advice with comics is like, hold up the page to somebody who doesn't read comics very often, and if they can read it, then it's clear, right?
Maybe. The answer is yes, maybe. Because it depends. It could give you new nuanced appreciation for the expert level of thing you created. So did if you purposefully created an expert reader level comic page and it's doing that job, it's well met. it's well met for its intended audience. Mm-hmm. If its not intended audience picks it up, and that's every tool, every single thing we make has some kind of well met audience and purposeful audience versus ones that are incidental or accidental. And, you know, like, what are you trying to go for? How much relevance do you want for that other audience?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's noble to say, oh, I want it to work for everybody. Fine. I'm a fan of that. I believe in making accessible systems and that's important, but not every artwork is going to be relatable to every audience. That's
right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like, knowing actually who you want to make it for is like powerful stuff, and it's not the easiest thing to come by.
That's one of the main drivers behind me trying to get the context for it, because mm-hmm. the thing that's created is probably to some extent not for me.
Yeah.
So who am I to show up and say, too spicy, not spicy enough, you know?
Right. Well, and that, I think that's why you and I carry the Twitter presence, is that we carry.
Sure.
Yeah. We do not show up ready to tell people how spicy or unspicy their meals are. Unless they ask, and then that's going to be a conversation that happens off Twitter before we engage with it.
Oh my gosh. Well, exactly. Because we're going to have to talk about what spice means before we even go one more step.
Yeah. So I guess that's another element to this that I think is important to underline, is that we are two people who have known each other for a good number of years. We've had a lot of conversations. We know a lot about each other's worldviews. So that even when you say, if you want to frame it up as like, well, you've got more language and experience in this realm. Yeah, maybe. But I also know that you think really hard about visual communication, design, readability. So you're going to have, and you have a level of thoughtfulness that I have been borne witness to directly. So I know that even if maybe you're not thinking about as many of the different options as maybe I am, which I would still debate, you're going to have a perspective that has value and has the opportunity to splash cold water in my face and make me see something I didn't see before. And if that happens, all I will feel is pure gratitude for that, because that is an opportunity for me to get to learn something new. And also there's that trust, because I've known you for so long. So I know that you would never say something with the intention of making me feel bad. Right. So even if it hurts, I know that it was delivered with loving intention.
Sure.
So that's
negative status reinforcement. Let's establish relationships through pain or tolerance, yeah. Or I don't know. Yeah.
So part of that, so this is what makes, like, I remember in the early days of webcomics, this is pre-social media, like the common wisdom was that you go onto forums, you get into discussions with people in forums, and then at the bottom of your forum post, you make sure that you have a footer, and the footer has a link to your webcomic. And I tried to get involved in these discussions, critiquing other people's work and getting involved in these, and it's just like, I didn't know these people well enough to be able to offer that in a way that I thought was meaningful. And when somebody would say, like, it just feels a little confusing with that kind of a layout, I'm like, that is, I guess, but that doesn't really give me a whole lot of context as to where you're coming from, what their intention was. This conversation feels like we're listening to half of a conversation through a wall, right? And so I think part of that brain trust thing.
We're shouting at each other's TVs, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I don't know why you're watching that.
And that's not to say that you can't have meaningful interactions on things like Reddit or PHP BB forums, because I did. And when my old webcomic The Front had a forum, it was a very, very warm and accepting place, and I was really proud of everybody who had engaged with it. And it became a self-policing thing, where like when somebody showed up one time and started like talking kind of aggressively, everybody lined up, like, we don't do that here. So, right. It can happen, but it's, I think it's a slower go. It's probably a slower go either way. Cause like even in person, it's not like you get to like these friendships we make, we live states away from one another. Right. And so without doing this weekly thing called the Lean Into Art Cast and then chatting afterwards, you know, we wouldn't have all that extra context and trust.
We spent a lot of time on our project and also building a relationship. So yeah, there's a lot of context there. That helps a lot. And I mean, so some kind of investment to build the, you know, to build that trust and build relationships that help you in a way that, gosh, one day I wrote a note about like what I thought about Dragon Ball Z, and it was something like, let's help one another become as strong as possible.
That's so good.
And I know that's probably not the exact premise, but that's the premise of what really speaks to me. Mm-hmm. And there's a bit of, you know, effort involved as far as finding that well-met space between, it's like, do you have enough common interests and different interests that can help one another build, and you actually care about building up one another?
And somebody, I think, from the leaner community who I think is a good example of this is Becca Hilburn, because she actually goes to Twitter and she shares the good and the bad, and she puts the thoughts out there for people to interact with, and she gets involved in the discussions. And I'm really impressed with how much she can invest in that, because I can't think and type like that quickly and respond in that kind of real-time scenario. We've had the discussion on the show before, is that like I overthink my posts to the point where I just don't do it. I talk myself out of it. But like Becca's great at, like, I think she's somebody I would look to say like, well, how do you connect with the community to find your brain trust? Well, look at what Becca's doing. I think she's doing a decent job of generating that, and then getting involved in some of those like those hashtag discussion groups. Like that's and then the other thing is like the way I've built my brain trust too is showing up to events and just striking up conversations. Like a lot of my friendships began with me just having a conversation with somebody, and just like something in my head says, be around that more if you can, right? And just like I show up to as many things as I can with that person, just listen for how I can help, kind of thing. God, that sounds stalkery. That's not what I meant.
No. I don't believe that's stalkery at all, because it's with the question of seeking to understand and serve, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, like stalkery is not that. I am not a psychologist, but I'm pretty sure that that's more predatorial, right?
Yeah.
So it has this discomfort of like, oh boy, we got to go meet people we don't know and then find out where things go, right? Mm-hmm. And follow up, and it may not be mutual. That mm-hmm. happens, right? Mm-hmm. But the in-person stuff, I mean, finding the meetups, going to the events, whatever your path is with that, if you're someone who is the enthusiast who honestly, this is a pretty clever approach, but where you go to events and you carry your comics with you and they're your business card and you have conversations. Great. Build, look for where you can help, and something takes hold. Like, it's funny. It's like I was a listener of Art and Story back in the day. And then I did something helpful on the forums and, you know, we connected and whatever. And like things build. I sat next to Tyler James at Baltimore Comic Con. What? And can you have, you know, you connected with him and have, you know, had various connections with him over the years since. And that participation, you can't beat it. And finding different ways, because just digital, just Twitter, just one forum, you know, it takes exploration and investment. Mm-hmm. But your people are out there.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I think is very helpful is be as curious about them as you can be. Like, meaning ask a lot of how and why questions when you're asking them about their work and about like their approach and what brought them to this thing in the first place. Not in an interview way, like tell me about your childhood, but in a way of like, you know, so something I try to do, this is an old thing that I probably mentioned on the show a long time ago, is that if I'm going to go meet somebody who I have a lot of respect for, I try to think of three things that they do that nobody else does as well or as effectively, or maybe it's something they do like in a very idiosyncratic way. I try to discover what those three things would be, at least hopefully three, sometimes it's not as many as three, but so that way when I strike up that conversation with them, I can point out that, like, look, I've thought a lot about your work, right? And I noticed that you do this a lot. Is that intentional? You do, like, even if in the case of, like, I met Dave Kellett, the strip cartoonist of Sheldon and Drive, and we were at ALA, and we just happened to be at the same party, and I came up and I mentioned the way he draws thumbs, right? Like, I noticed he draws thumbs this way. Is that intentional? He's like, no, I didn't notice that until you pointed that out to me. We both got a good laugh out of it. But then when I met Chris Giarrusso for the first time, and like I first thing I said to him was like, wow, you have really, really good image to text ratio on your pages. And he's like, I don't think anybody's ever said that to me before. And he's like, he looks down, he's like, I guess it's pretty good. I don't really think about it. It's like the way I do it. And I'm like, well, let's talk about it now. Let's talk about like instances where we see bad image to text ratio and good image to text ratio. So it becomes a talking point where you're identifying the fact that you've thoughtfully engaged with their work, which is what every one of us wants. Every one of us wants to have that conversation with somebody who's like listened, paid attention, interacted in a thoughtful way, and then brings that back to you. That's an enormous way to start building trust. So, and it doesn't take that much work.
It doesn't, other than it's an element of pausing. Before, you know, because we all have piles and piles of needs and curiosities and questions and desires, and so, you know, to be recognized and see the potential in our work and find, who knows, business connections, collaborators, all sorts of needs. But like if you go into it with the desire to really respect the other person's time and have that effort that shows that shows your thoughtfulness and that it essentially demonstrates your interest in relating to them and their work. Mm-hmm. And then if you do try to relate your work into the conversation, I think that also requires an investment of thoughtfulness and have an intent. Is if you pull out a deck of sketches and don't have a question, now you've made it their job to come up with the context for this. Mm-hmm. So if you're respectful of their time and their attention, then you will try to not make it their job and say, I'm at this point of this thing in the project and I really think this. I'm trying to get better at that. Mm-hmm. What do you think? That kind of thing. I mean, so it's, yeah, try to have a mission for your questions.
Oh, that's good. Have a mission for your questions. I like that a lot. Did we do a podcast? Do we have a final thought?
A final thought. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. There's always more thought. So,
okay.
We do have one more ad spot.
Yes, we do. All right.
We'll
I'll take it away then, and we'll figure out what our final thought is. So we got to thank a couple more people who make the show possible, and those people happen to be us. We make stuff, and then we bring the thoughts that occur when we make the stuff into this thing we call Lean Into Art. And the thing that I hope you will engage with that I am involved in making is the Ann Arbor Comic Arts Festival next weekend, everybody. We are a week away from the kickoff of A2CAF. It's at a2caf.com. It's a free comics festival in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And this is the last time you're going to hear me talk about it for a while. And this last time you're going to hear me talk about this, the Kids Comics Awards. There is literally, at the time of this recording, 8 days left to vote for your favorite comics of 2018. Only kids can vote. So if you have some young people in your lives, you can please point them at the ballot. There's an online ballot. It's actually, as of tomorrow, it's too late to do the mail-in ballot. But they can still use the online ballot at a2caf.com/kidscomicsawards. They can vote for their favorite comics of the past year. And the winners will be announced at a2caf, and the winners will receive cute little Lego trophies. When we announce the winner, we always say, and the kids chose, because yes, this is the award for cartoonists who make comics for kids, and the winners are chosen by kids. So once again, that's a2caf.com/kidscomicsawards. Voting ends in 8 days. Rob, you made a class.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I made and published a class through Skillshare, and it's called Well, it's drawing user journey maps, and it's all about thoughtful collaboration, kind collaboration, inclusive collaboration. And the journey maps are this mechanism that you can use to put yourself and all your collaborators in the shoes of your audience. Think about your user. Think about what it's like when they, what it's even before they encounter the thing you made, and then when they encounter it and how it continues from there. You think about progress over time. It's like a storyboard. It's things that you're pretty familiar with, guaranteed. But then when you're doing that to create a product or a service, and it's so easy to think about, well, we've been getting a lot of complaints about this thing. It's the, you know, we've got negative reviews and we've just got to jump at this. Well, wait a minute. What's the journey of the user? How can we understand this more and do it in a way that gets a wide perspective? So we're not making assumptions just based on maybe what we think from a design perspective, representing the users. Let's also include the business and also the people who build the things, the, you know, engineering or artists or other things that are those builders and where you're working. Maybe you. User journey maps are a fantastic way to they're just a great mechanism for collaboration. And this class gets you up and running. And it's just 47 minutes, and it's available at Skillshare. If you go to my website, there's an easy link right on the homepage that goes straight to it. And if you sign up for Skillshare through that link, you get like 2 free months. That's kind of awesome. And you get to enjoy the Drawing User Journey Maps class.
Terrific. And if you are here because, you know, you don't really care about the stuff we make as much as the stuff that we do on the show, fair enough. The show is, I would actually argue that User Journey Maps is more like this show. It's more like it's Rob teaching and not so much Rob's games. So that actually is a lot like this. But there's more stuff like it at leonatart.com/workshops, where you can download self-contained videos at a price of your choosing, even free. If you're watching the video on YouTube, giving it a thumbs up helps more people find the show. If you haven't subscribed yet, please subscribe. And if you're listening to the show in a podcatcher like iTunes, Apple Podcasts, whatever, iTunes is going away, isn't it? So Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, giving us a 5-star review wherever you listen to us helps more people find the show as well. And we thank everybody who's been doing that. It means a lot to us.
Yes, it does. So much. Then we have a final thought, don't we?
I hope so.
Okay. There was something, I don't know if you were just highlighting a thing, but there's this idea that was mentioned in the show notes that I don't know if we really honed in on. And I think listening is really important. Mm-hmm. It is a skill. So what do you think comes out of like skillful listening?
Oh man. When somebody's critiquing your work, I have felt the strong desire to go, yeah, but well, what I was going for was, but if you only look over here, right? Like I'm hearing what they're saying and I'm instantly seeing counter arguments to what they're saying. Like for instance, the thing that Dan and I just talked about this last week, the project he was helping me with. Oh man, did I rebel? Did I ever rebel? Cause I'm like, you are not getting my point, Dan. And Dan came back to me and says, I think I am, but I think you're missing another point, right? And so like, there was a lot of back and forth in that. And I wanted to interrupt him because I had it. I had the thing. All I want you to tell me is whether or not it's good. Well, that's what he was doing. And I just wasn't listening, right? And when I finally calmed myself the heck down and just read through what he sent me and read it again and then read it one more time, went for a 20-minute walk, came back, read it another time, I was like, yeah, I see what he's saying now. What you get from listening is you're hearing somebody say what you said in their own words, or at least they're trying to. And maybe when they say what you said in their own words, they're telling you how you sound to somebody else, right?
So, that's, yeah. There's so many listening moments, right? There's the point when, getting to the point in a relationship where it makes sense to ask for the critique. There's listening all the way through there, right? Because maybe you can decide where, like, you're not really on the same page in enough ways, or there isn't enough willingness and whatnot. Then don't worry about it. Use what you're learning from your listening, and then when you do find that great resource. The person that's willing to invest and go there with you and question and critique, then yeah, that's a huge another time to listen to. That's a hard time. Like you pointed out, oh my gosh.
It's not a great place to be emotionally. Right. But yeah, there's a difference between somebody saying I'll do a phony example of like useful and non-useful critique. Is somebody looking at, say, Pickles and Taff and saying like, yeah, where was the blood? How come there's no blood in this? And I'm like, well, you know, you clearly have entirely different expectations of what I'm trying to do here. You're asking for something that I just don't do. And so in that case, it's not helpful critique. Yeah, I'm sorry you're disappointed in that you were looking for something where pigs are covered in blood while hanging out with tortoises, but, you know, that's not what this comic is going to be under any circumstances, right? Whereas somebody saying like, oh, I see you're trying to do like high-octane action adventure with really, really cute characters. Well, I think you'd get there a little bit better if you just tried A, B, or C, right? And then I can look at that. Now I've got like context. Now I can say like, okay, well, maybe A is not so much my style. B, that's interesting. Maybe I could play with that. I'll try it. Eh, I don't like it. Well, maybe I'll try C, right? Well, it was worth an experiment. Maybe I'm not going to do any of them, but they're offering me something. They're giving me a gift to explore improving my thing, right? Depending on all those other criteria that we talked about earlier, like how much do we trust them? What's their experience level? Where are they coming from? Are they listening to me? Am I listening to them? But yeah, like sitting quietly while somebody's critiquing your stuff is tough. That's a tough one.
No doubt. Right. And it's separating signal from noise, because you might be in a critique situation where that person is, you know, they want Pickles and Taft Mortal Kombat, but they do have other points. And so then it's like sifting through the critique and using that skillful listening to like get the information. And I think one of the key differences for me that I guess I've lucked out and it's helped me with critique is that I care a lot about research. And so I'm listening to discover more than I'm listening to confirm most of the time. And that's, I think that just comes from practicing the research thing. And so I kind of lucked out there. And, because you can find the information then, as opposed to finding the lack of reinforcement of, tell me I was right. Come on. When are you going to tell me I was right? I know it's coming. And I just have to sit through all this stuff. You could be losing so much good information in that mindset. So
listening to discover,
discovering that, versus confirming.
Yeah. Discovering versus confirming it's an interesting balancing act, but it's a vital one. And I think that's a really nice succinct way to check yourself is the way you phrase that. Am I listening to discover or am I listening to confirm? Because when I sent that thing to Dan, I was listening to confirm. I was like, tell me this is good. You know, and he's like, well, it is, except it's not. So it's good.
Yeah. Oh yeah. We all get invested emotionally and that's, that does make it tense, but it's a skill, you know, totally learnable.
And if I could put one last thought on that, listening to discover means that you are more, well, you can confirm, you can tell me if I'm right or wrong in this, but in my experience, when I listen to discover, it's because I'm more at ease with the fact that I'm not done with this thing. Whereas when I'm urgently trying to just get it out the door, then I'm listening to confirm usually. So that's another thing I check myself on. It's like, let's remind ourselves that this is, you're going to go through 10 drafts and that's okay. That's part of the discovery, right?
That's interesting, because there could be points in your project where you are past having the capacity to invest again, right? Mm-hmm. And then why are you researching at that point?
Yeah.
Because it would have been probably you'd have more impact from your effort for researching earlier on before, you know, this shipping deadline or whatever was looming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is why we critiqued our mini comics, because that's not that big of an investment.
Yeah.
So let's not do that with something that took us 3 years to make. I think we did a podcast now, Rob.
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for downloading, watching, and listening. We record the show every Thursday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central. We stream it live on YouTube and then collect it as a podcast at leanintoart.com and patreon.com/leanintoart. We'll be back soon with another episode. Until then, I have been Jersey Drozd of leanintoart.com and Jersey Drozd on Instagram.
And I have been Rob Stenzinger of leanintoart.com. And I'm also Rob Stenzinger on that old Instagram.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart. And you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.